Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. US bound. As Pope Benedict prepares for his upcoming visit to the United States, we ask a cardinal and a religious sister how this trip is being seen. Answering God's call. On the eve of Vacation Sunday, we find out from one recently ordained priest in London about how he discerned his vocation and overcame hostility from his family. And St. John's Bible. We talk to the artist and calligrapher of the world's first handwritten and illuminated Bible in more than 500 years. Pope Benedict is preparing for his six-day pastoral visit to the United States next week, his first trip there as Pope. He leaves next Tuesday the 15th for Washington, D.C., where his engagements include a formal welcome by President Bush at the White House, an open-air mass in a new baseball stadium, an address to the heads of Catholic colleges and universities, and a meeting with representatives of other faiths. On Friday, he heads to New York City, where he will address the United Nations General Assembly. His other engagements there include a visit to Ground Zero and a mass at the city's Yankee Stadium. He returns to Rome on Sunday the 20th. Whilst in the US, Pope Benedict will mark two important anniversaries, his 81st birthday on the 16th of April and 3 days later, the third anniversary of his election to the papacy. The US is the first foreign trip by the Pope this year, but his second trip, scheduled for late July, is also to an Anglophone nation, Australia, where he will attend the World Youth Day celebrations in the city of Sydney. Cardinal George Pell, the Archbishop of Sydney, talked to my colleague Charles Collins about how these trips to the US and Australia will give the English-speaking world a chance to get better acquainted with Pope Benedict's message.
The Pope, he hasn't gone to English-speaking countries before. Do you see this year as the year where the Pope's ideas, his teachings, even his person, becomes more widely known throughout the Anglosphere?
Yes, I do. And I think that this will be a very good thing because he deserves to be known. Now, the other side of the coin is that he knows the English-speaking world well, through the intellectual world, through his readings. Through his discussions with church leaders. He's very, very well informed, and he's a marvellous teacher, so I look forward to what he has to say in the United States, as I do to what he has to say later in Australia at the World Youth Day. I think it'll be a great blessing for us all and a big help to evangelism, a help to all sorts of people, not just the young who are searching for meaning and purpose in their lives.
Moving to the US itself, Camille D'Arienzo is a Sister of Mercy based in New York City. She says there's an air of great excitement and expectation surrounding the Pope's upcoming visit there.
There's a great deal of enthusiasm regarding the upcoming papal visit. And as I look at it, it has a timeliness all its own, because there have been so many demonstrations against China's human rights violations and people trying to impede the Olympic torch on its journey to that destination. And yet here we have one of the world's most prominent human rights advocates preparing to come to our country. People see him with great enthusiasm, not only Catholics, but also people who are looking for a strong voice to protest the injustices. The war in Iraq is a very big concern for many people here, a real revulsion about its continuance. And so people are hoping that the Holy Father will address that as one of his priorities.
What other issues are people hoping that the Holy Father will address during his visit?
Well, I guess if you look on the broader scale, people are looking for the Holy Father's attention to things he has already committed himself to. The right of all people to enjoy human decency and dignity, not to be persecuted, not to be excluded, not to be mistreated. I mean, we know so much about the tragedies in other parts of the world. For instance, the trafficking of women. Great concern about women and children who are being abused all over. In our country, yes, although not as much as, let's say, in Africa, in Darfur, in other places around the world, Pakistan. So there is that concern. He has spoken out on these issues before, and we expect that he will do more to advocate for lives free of persecution, poverty, and perpetual humiliation.
Of course, one of the most moving moments will be in New York, this is, when he will go to visit Ground Zero. What do you think New Yorkers would like to hear from him there? A plea for forgiveness?
Well, I think there's always the desire for a plea for forgiveness because that is central to Catholicism, you know, for forgiveness and for redemption, but also for an end to the retaliation that the United States has sponsored against the countries first of Afghanistan and now Iraq. The Pope pleaded not to start the war, then to end the war, to his concern for the 1 million Iraqis and the over 4,000 American troops who are dead, to say nothing of all those who have suffered physical devastation, amputees, mentally ill, and the impact of that on the economy and on the lives of so many.
Are there any visible signs of preparation for this papal visit?
Oh, yes. Lots of publicity in the press, both the general press and the religious press. A great deal of excitement among practicing Catholics. And I believe they say that we have 62 million Catholics in the United States and maybe a third or fewer attend regular Mass. But there is this sense that the Catholic Church has to offer the gospel of Jesus, which is salvific, which is healing, which leads to reconciliation. So there's great enthusiasm. School children are very excited. Yankee Stadium, which is the site of so many sports events and which will soon be demolished, is it's going to be the site of great excitement. There is another trend, though, that is very important here in the American church. We are losing priests. We have fewer priests than are needed to meet the needs of the people for the Eucharist.
So if you had to sum up, you know, some of the main pastoral fruits of this journey.
We would like the Holy Father to continue what he has already done so very well, speak out against all violence, from war to persecution to the taking of human life anywhere.
That was Sister Camille D'Arienzo speaking from New York City. And earlier you heard the voice of Cardinal George Pell of Sydney. On April the 13th, the Catholic Church celebrates Vocation Sunday throughout the world. And the theme chosen this year by Pope Benedict is Vocations at the Service of the Church on Mission. Vocation Sunday is a day when the Church prays specifically for vocations to the priesthood and consecrated life. In the UK, over 4,000 posters and other materials have been distributed amongst parishes, university chaplaincies and schools in the run-up to this Vocation Sunday. Figures show that there are currently 160 men training to become priests in England and Wales, the highest figures for a number of years. But the flip side of the coin is that many of the current generation of priests are now coming up to retirement age, and currently there are not enough men being ordained to replace them. Each candidate for the priesthood arrives at his vocation in a different way. But let's find out from a recently ordained priest in London how he discerned and answered God's call in this regard. Father Richard Nesbitt was ordained in the summer of 2007 and is now part of a newly formed team set up to promote vocations in the Archdiocese of Westminster. I began by asking him the obvious first question. Why did he decide to become a priest?
Well, to cut a long story very short, I went out to Poland in 1990. I graduated from university and went out there to teach English as a foreign language. And as a young man in my 20s, very much looking for kind of a direction in life, I was completely bowled over by the people I met there. I wasn't a Christian at the time, and contact with those people really, first of all, brought me to be baptized. I was baptized at the grand old age of 28 out in Poland. And then from that, which was in 1994, very quickly, the idea of taking that further and sort of offering myself as completely as I could to God through the priesthood really grew and grew and grew. So I came back from Poland in 2001. And joined the seminary here in London.
So in a sense, it was the fervour of that Catholic faith that you saw amongst the Polish people that helped to inspire you or move you to along that road.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I'd been a bit of a nomad, really, for that kind of my life to that point. I'd travelled around a lot and been a bit of a butterfly, really, just trying different things, different cultures, different faiths as well. And I think it was the sense of community, first of all, which really struck me. And then when I dug a bit deeper, I discovered that what held that community together was very much faith.
There was never any time when you kicked against the traces, when you felt this vocation. You always felt that this was the right path to undertake. Or did you ever have any doubts at all?
Well, the initial period, I arrived in Poland in 1990, just after all of the political changes had started there after the fall of the Berlin Wall and everything. From that point to being baptized took 4 years, and I certainly had a lot of questions that I needed to be answered. But God really guided me and sent people who were able to answer those questions in a very unpressurizing way. They weren't judging me, they were just very patiently listening to my questions, answering them, and showing me that they were living out those answers in their own life, which meant a lot to me. So when I came to that point at the Easter Vigil in 1994, it was a decision which I had taken a long time to take, really. It was a decision which I knew, for example, that my parents, my family were going to struggle with. So it wasn't one that I took lightly. But when I took that decision, and from that very moment of being baptized, I just knew that I had found that deep well, if you like, of living water, which I'd been looking for so long. I think immediately, actually, from the moment I was baptized, I knew that I wanted to be a priest.
Did you at any point ever have a sign that helped you to discern your vocation?
I certainly discovered the beauty of prayer and had very, very powerful experiences of a deep feeling of God's presence and God's voice directing me. When I came closer and closer to the church, towards the church, when I discovered more and more about the priestly life, my heart burned. I felt that I was truly alive and that this was indeed what God had created me to do and to be. It was a great gift. I really did have, from the very first moment after being baptized, this very clear sense of God leading me to this great privilege of the priesthood.
You mentioned earlier that your family weren't exactly overjoyed at your decision. Were they quite hostile at first to it?
They were very hostile.
Why was that?
Because of their own personal history, their own experience of faith in their own lives. Every person's life is a complicated journey, and I think particularly in their youth, if for different reasons, they had bad experiences of the church, and for their own reasons had kind of rejected that path in their lives. So my father would very much see himself as an atheist. And my mother, although she has a belief in God, she has her belief, unfortunately, is in quite a vengeful and angry God. And I think that they felt that God was taking me away from them, really, that they were losing their son. And that was something that, I was very sensitive to and obviously caused both sides a lot of pain and had to realize that I needed to really show them, not just through words, but through actions, that they hadn't lost me, that I loved them, and that this new life that I'd been called to was one that was going to help me grow in that love. It wasn't going to be something that would take me away from them. When I was ordained last summer, in June 2007, my mother, up to the very last moment, was not sure that she would be actually coming. But at the last moment, she did come. And when I was ordained in Westminster Cathedral, there she was in the front pew with my father and my sister. And they came forward for a blessing at communion time, which was a great surprise to me. And we both just cried our eyes out. I gave her a big hug and she hugged me back. And it just felt like we'd come on such a long journey, which, you know, took 15 years and a journey which continues.
Is being a priest more or less as you expected, or are there some things that are really different to what you imagined beforehand?
Well, our seminary training lasts 6 years here, and a very important part of that is practical work. We have a whole year out in the parish, so that we're not ordained without knowing the life which we are going to go to. But since being ordained last summer, it is completely 24/7. There's no kind of long summer holiday, as I've had for years and years, either as a student or as a teacher. So it's a lot more relentless, and I don't mean that in a negative way. When you're out in the parish, really, I think possibly at the seminary, we are often a little bit kind of self-focused. There's a lot sort of focused on yourself and your own development. When you're out in the parish, really, it's far more self-giving. You need to be able to nourish yourself, obviously, have time for reflection. But it is, I suppose, mirroring Christ's own example, very much that pouring out of self day after day after day. When in the parish where I am in London, we are responsible for a hospital. We're the first parish of call for that hospital. So we can be called out quite often during the week, you know, during the night and things like that. There are times when that's tough, but when you get there to the hospital, it's just an extraordinary privilege. The situation which God has called you to be in, the trust which people have for you immediately, the affection they have for the priest. It's extraordinary, really. I mean, you certainly couldn't write the script for it. No 2 days are the same. And just the privilege of it is, you know, the extraordinary situations that you find yourself in day after day after day. And God gives you the strength. You know, if you thought about it too much beforehand, you might just sort of stay in bed. But God leads you. So it's a very humbling, very, very humbling experience.
Did you worry about the fact that you would have to live a chaste life? This must be something that presumably many young men might find difficult to come to terms with.
Again, I think the wisdom of taking time with this, I mean, it's not a decision which I made in haste. Obviously, we have 6 years of seminary formation, and that is one of the central questions which every seminarian has to face. We're called to be fruitful. We're called to be loving. Certainly, one of the things I've experienced in the parish in my first year is so much of the priest's life is about building up relationships, being in relationships, caring relationships, loving relationships. And I found that creativity, that desire to love and to be loved, is very much fed as a priest. Of course, yes, of course, there are times of regret, of longing, really, for that part of yourself which isn't fully used, if you like, as a priest. But it's an entering deeper and deeper into that mystery of being called to a deeper way to love, really.
I was speaking there to Father Richard Nesbitt, a recently ordained priest in London. A great work of art, a work for eternity. These were the words used by Pope Benedict when he was presented last week with a limited edition reproduction of the St. John's Bible, the first handwritten illuminated Bible commissioned in more than 500 years. The Pope received the Wisdom Books volume at a presentation in the Vatican during the annual meeting of the Papal Foundation. He will receive the remaining 6 volumes of the Bible over the next 4 years. The $4 million project, funded by private donations, was commissioned by St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, one of the largest Benedictine monasteries in the world. The Bible's British artist, Donald Jackson, was also present at the audience with the Pope. Over the past 10 years, he and a team of calligraphy experts painstakingly painted every page on parchment, using feather quills, natural handmade inks, hand-ground pigments, and gold leaf to illustrate the original handwritten text. But while the methods used to illustrate St. John's Bible are hundreds of years old, the imagery has such modern touches as a picture of the Twin Towers to illustrate forgiveness in the gospel parable of the prodigal son. Donald Jackson said it has always been his greatest wish to handwrite and illuminate the Bible. At a press conference following the presentation of the St. John's Bible to the Pope, I asked Jackson to explain his reasons.
I've been doing calligraphy since I was a 9-year old. And when you start doing it, you start copying illuminated manuscripts, or you try to. And then I went to art school, and I always was interested in graphic art. I still specialize in calligraphy and lettering. The real source and fountain in Western culture for calligraphy is the Bible and essentially Christian works, which are spin-off from that. I think most calligraphers have that idea. This is the Sistine Chapel of the calligrapher lettering artist's mental imagination, really. This is the big one. This is it. To do the Bible. To do it. I mean, experience it, write it, and you really do have to experience it, because a lot of these images have been dredged up from within, basically. And I answer to a group of theologians at St. John's University, and they sketch out what things they think are important. So, and again, the reason why this is not a Bible that could have been done at any other time is they would not have featured, for instance, the feminine. I mean, that was probably distinctly lacking in 700 years ago, I guess. But they also briefed me to do that, and they briefed me also, and also their choice of illuminations, where they would have them. I mean, for instance, they haven't asked me to do Jonah being swallowed by a whale, which was something which in the Middle Ages was absolutely required. Everybody had to see these monsters and these great things. Well, that wasn't asked for now. What informs their choice is a modern outlook.
Did you have sometimes disagreements over what the illustrations should be?
No. You see, what I do is I listen to their brief, I read it carefully, I then look at the Bible, and then I reread and I play back and forth, and I get a feeling for what I think is the punchline, if you look at it that way. For instance, there are many different ways you could illustrate the crucifixion. Could you concentrate on a weeping child at the foot of the cross? Would you concentrate on Mary's grief? You've got many different points. So, as an artist, I do choose what I think is the punchline. Now, there has been a point where, I'll give you an example, the baptism of Christ by John the Baptist. Now, to me, the punchline was, after being tempted by the devil being cast out was a real dramatic moment, and suddenly angels came, and the whole air, as it were, was filled to support Jesus in his coming out and his realization, and he's got rid of temptation. That was the punchline for me. But the Roman Catholic theology is, the punchline is actually nowhere near there. It's very close physically. He leaves there and, of course, meets up with John the Baptist and is baptized, and then the sky opens, as it were, and God says, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased," or whatever translation. That's the big moment. Well, I don't have a problem with that. I saw it one way, but I'm not wedded to that. That was what they wanted. They felt that is the moment, and I had no problem switching from that. It's not meant to be controversial. It's meant to make contact and then cause discussion. I've seen people weep over the pages of the original, walk in and just weep. And I am sort of horrified, because I hadn't mean people to weep. I mean, but I've suddenly realized it's taken on a life of its own.
And what were the pages that these people were weeping
over? You name it. I've had a letter last week. Somebody said, I walked into the exhibition, I started crying, and I didn't stop till I went through the other end. So I don't know. I mean, a group of Buddhist monks have walked into St. John's, into where there was one of the pages on display. They all knelt and prayed, and then walked away. I don't know. It's become its own thing now.
Has your own understanding of the Bible and the message within it changed or modified in some way as you've taken on this work and been doing it?
Well, I mean, it's just like peeling off layers of an onion. I mean, I've got deeper and deeper into a lot of the understanding of it. I think, well, when you go through that process of peeling back the onion, of course you do. And what I really come out of it this at the end of this is just how significant these texts are, how they stand up in this day and age. They really are. They have in them so much that is really difficult to swallow. In fact, probably not possible to swallow whole. But then it's there to talk about, and then that takes you on to another place. I actually think really significant, wonderful texts.
Coming to your equipment, as you said, this is equipment that's been used for hundreds of years, quills and hand mixing the paints. Are there any sort of concessions to modernity in your equipment?
Yes, sure. The whole thing was laid out on computer beforehand. It was a CD on a disc. It came from the translator, this particular edition, which is the New Revised Standard Edition.
The project wanted to be an ecumenical one that was not just for Catholics, was it?
Well, it's ecumenical more in spirit because the people who briefed me are open. They chose the New Revised Standard Version because they thought it was... Because one of the reasons, it's used by so many other churches. It's used by the Congregational Church in the United States. It's used in the Church of England and the Episcopalian Church in the US. It's used by the Methodists. So they thought, number one, let's talk with a common voice, as it were, I guess. But it's, as I say, it's a Roman Catholic ordering. And so ecumenical is too strong a word. I think it's not that. It's just sharing. It's about saying, look, we're all got different roads to the same thing, and that this should be as open as possible. And so sprinkled throughout this are designs taken, not just, as I was saying, from the images of around us in modern life. You've got it on this very page here, which is the opening of Ecclesiastes. I have used Islamic medieval astronomical diagrams here, and I've overlaid them onto Hubble telescope images and images from NASA of the birth of a star and of the universe. You'll find in other parts, even in the New Testament, in the Gospels and Acts, I've used Buddhist mandala, cosmic mandala images, and there are also other sprinklings of the actual Gospel and Acts starts with a huge menorah and with a Hebrew ordering of all of the ancestors of Christ.
How long did it take on average to write each page when there was just, say, a written page?
Well, each person varies, interestingly. On the original, every scribe notates on the top of the page exactly how long it takes them. Now, that varies from, I would say, 7 hours, maybe even 6.5 hours for a text page, to one of the scribes who would take up to 13 hours to write the same. Certain scripts take less time.
When it comes to an illustration, say a full-page illustration, that must take a long time, doesn't it?
It does, but then a lot of it is time is spent, for instance, on this one, this one of Ecclesiastes, probably took, I don't know, 3 weeks to work out the actual design, and then maybe 7 or 8 days to finish as an art piece of art. Much quicker to do it than to work it out, because you can't make mistakes. You know, that writing's in place, so I can't afford to let that paint go over onto the writing. So it's not like a canvas. I'm not painting like an artist with a canvas where I can scrape it off again or even get a new canvas. This is part of a page which is not only written there, it's also written on the other side of here. And it also is part of another page. So you're sometimes working on a page which has had 3 other artists already working on it. And so you have to shed that feeling of fear and go for it.
How will you feel when it's all finished?
I know my wife will feel enormously glad, but because it's gone on about 3-4 years longer than it should have. I will feel that it won't have finished. I think it'll still be working in me till I die.
A life-changing experience, then?
Life-enhancing.
I was talking there to Donald Jackson, calligrapher and artistic director of the St. John's Bible Project. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.